Mauro Bellino is an internationally best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for Rome's St. Paul Press as a Bible translator, providing with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. It is an exacting discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. Mauro's findings set him at odds with the conventional expectations of the Catholic world and propelled him onto the international stage, where his work has opened up a world of cultural memory recorded in the Bible. Yet hidden from the public for centuries by mistaken translation and the dogmas of the church.
Good morning. Let's continue with our parallels between the Bible and Homeric poems. Today we are talking about a very delicate topic, which is that of flying cars. It's a very delicate topic because we know well that traditional exegesis does not even accept the hypothesis that the Bible talks about flying machines. Although in reality it is quite clear that the Bible talks about them, but not just the Bible, I would say in general the ancient texts. There are, for example, the so-called apocryphal texts studied by Professor Luigi Maraldi, who I have already mentioned several times in these videos, and who is a source of sources, that is, he is cited by experts, who says, for example, that in the Hebrew Book of Enoch, there are 23 types of divine chariots, 23 different types. The Bible does not know 23 of them. It knows a little less. But for example, it knows the Ruach, it knows the Kavod, it knows the Ephai, it knows the Megillah, it knows the Merkava. In short, there are several different types. But let's go back for a moment, or rather, let's start for a moment from the Iliad, from the Homeric poems. Some of you will remember that in a previous video, I talked about the flying chariots used by the so-called Homeric gods, flying chariots that are held aloft and made to travel by horses, which, as I recall, are defined as upsikis. For example, in this translation by Rosa Calzecchi Onesti, published by Einaudi as Alto Nitrenti, but we saw in that video that in reality upsikis actually means those making noise up high, which, as you understand, is something completely different, and we will see the biblical equivalent in a moment. But now, let's add another element to these celestial chariots. Here we are in the 8th book of the Iliad, which tells of a moment in which Hera, that is the wife of Zeus, and Athena, the daughter, decide to go directly into battle to give help to the army which they sided with and which was in trouble at the time. So what does Athena do? Athena decides to enter into battle wearing the tunic of Zeus who gathers the clouds. Then he puts on the tunic of Zeus to enter the fight. Who knows what this tunic was? Then he says, he surrounded himself with weapons for the frantic battle, and leaped onto the flaming chariot, and grabbed the heavy, thick, heavy spear with which she overthrows the hosts of heroes if she becomes angry with them. Well, so then he dresses in a particular way, climbs into the flaming chariot, and gets a special weapon. Well, this gesture does not please Zeus, who would have wanted his men to remain outside of that dispute between the Greeks and the Trojans. So what does Zeus say? But Father Zeus, as soon as he saw them from Ida, he says he saw them because it is the two who enter the battle. Hera and Athena became terribly angry and sent the ambassador Airi, the golden wing. Airi goes quickly. Send her back. Don't let them come before me. It's not nice to come to blows. That is, here are gods who truly contend, quarrel, fight among themselves. And I say this, which will certainly come to fruition. Attention. I will break the legs of their fast horses under the chariot. I will throw them from the chariot. I will smash this chariot, which is called the chariot, here, and not even in 10 years will the wounds heal that lightning can inflict on them. That is, here it is said that these horses that carry up and that guide the carts and move them forward are found under the carts. Therefore, contrary to the traditional iconography, which obviously reads these texts as mythical texts depicting the usual chariot pulled by carts. As you know, we always pretend that things written in a literal way are true, and therefore we know that these horses make noise above. And here we learn that these horses are placed under the carts, and from there, they hold them aloft. Among other things, here is also a rather curious and ironic note, because verse 407 says that, essentially, he addresses this threat to his daughter Athena and says, "I'm not that angry, and I don't take it out on Hera. She always opposes what I mean." It's nice to see the Lord of the Gods here saying, "Okay, I'm not taking this to heart because my wife is used to contradicting everything I say, but instead I take it out on my daughter because she owes me something and must obey me." In short, it is a truly very human, very concrete thing, and I honestly find it difficult to imagine. If you wanted to talk about divinities, one could invent such trivial things that would be almost ridiculous if attributed to the Lord of the Gods. Then, when these vehicles travel and when they land, they are wrapped in a cloud. So, we have this fairly precise clue that makes us think of something technological, because it is something that's making noise high up. It is something... Do we want to call these horses engines? But yes, we pretend anyway, so it's not a problem. These engines are below, so much so that Zeus says that he will hit them from below, causing the chariot to fall. And now we come to the Bible. Let's talk about Ezekiel, where there is a narrative about these chariots, which again is really very precise. And these chariots, as I said before, are known by various names in the Bible, and they are also different typologies, because they are present at the same time, so it is clear that these are different things. For example, in the first chapter, Ezekiel says, after having specifying exactly the day, month, and year, he says, "I saw a violent wind coming from the north, a great cloud with lightning and splendor all around, and in the center, like the glittering of electrum in the midst of the fire. Behold, I saw a violent wind coming from the north." In Hebrew, there is ruach, which is often also translated as spirit, understood as the Spirit of God. And in fact, the explanation that is given, the theological explanation that is given of this so-called vision, is precisely relating to the Spirit of God. But in the meantime, here we take note of the fact that, like the Homeric chariots, which obviously travel in a precise direction, come down from the mountain, enter into battle. Here it says that this wind comes from the north. Then we go on to read other characteristics. Ezekiel, at a certain point, is picked up by this wind, by this ruach, and says, "Then a ruach, that is, a spirit, lifted me up, and I heard the roar of a great earthquake behind me, while the glory of the Lord rose from that place." So here is a ruach that takes him, and he hears. He hears a great noise, as the kavod of Yahweh, which is translated as glory of the Lord, rose up from that place and says, "And I heard behind me." Then, as this ruach was about to pick him up, he hears the noise behind his back, a great noise produced by the kavod of Yahweh rising up. Now, if the Kavod of Yahweh is what theology says is the glory of God, we must take note that this glory is fixed in one place. It rises, and when it rises, it produces a great noise. The text says, I heard the roar of the wings of these beings beating against each other, and at the same time, the roar of the wheels and the noise of a great uproar. Of course, the glory of God really makes a great noise. The Ruach lifted me up and carried me away. Then, yet another very precise description. Again, in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth of the month, we are actually in 591 BC, while I was sitting at home, that is, in short, in the courtyard of his house, and in front of me the elders of Judah were sitting. The hand of God came upon me. It seemed to me that he stretched out an arm. A ruach supported me between earth and heaven, and took me to Jerusalem in a vision of Elohim. That is, he saw it as the people saw it, Elohim that is from above, and he takes him to the entrance of the inner gate that faces north, and behold, there again was the glory of the God of Israel as I had seen it on the plain. That is, here again there is a ruach who takes him, lifts him, takes him to Jerusalem in a very specific position. That is, the internal gate facing north. And there stands the Kavod of Yahweh, that is, the glory of God. And he says, and it is the same glory, that is, the same Kavod that I had seen before in the plain, the one that I read there previously. And here too, since it was placed in the courtyard of the temple, a cloud filled the courtyard of the temple, and when the glory of the Lord was raised by the cherub, bringing it above the threshold of the temple, the temple was filled with the cloud, and the courtyard was filled with the splendor of the glory of the Lord. That is, this Kavod of Yahweh emitted light, and the temple was filled by that light while the Kavod went up. But now soon we will see an even more precise description, drawing a parallel with the Greek text of the Bible of the 70. And he says the noise of the cherub's wings could be heard even in the external courtyard. That is, it means that all this happened in the internal courtyard, and whoever was in the external courtyard did not see but heard the noise that all this set of devices made. That is, the description is very clear. If someone doesn't like it, they can say that it is a vision. They can say that it's about a dream, and in some way, they have to justify it, because here, Ezekiel shows that he is clearly awake, he has a clear conscience, and he even says day, month, year, because the author of this book wants to be sure of what he is telling. So, if someone doesn't like it, they can turn all this into a dream or a vision. But the Bible clearly talks about flying machines and describes them. And it's curious to think that, in a vision, one can see things like these, describe them in this way without having ever seen them even once. It is difficult to think about the description of certain effects, such as the one we will see now, thinking that it is a dream. That is, one has dreamed of something he has never seen, ever. Or he has, in a waking dream vision, and I don't know how, seen something he has never encountered. Instead, Ezekiel says he met him and also makes comparisons. He says, what I saw here is like what I saw there. It is exactly the same, and every time the so-called glory of God is always well localized. Then we move forward, and thus we arrive at this comparison with the Greek text, which is very, very enlightening. In chapter 43 of Ezekiel, it says, and behold the glory of the Lord coming from the east. Here too, again, if it were really about the glory of Yahweh, that is understood as a spiritual attribute, we would have to think that, since it comes from the east, It is not there in the West, but neither in the North nor in the South. So it is a very limited glory. In reality, in Hebrew, it is the kavod of Yahweh, who comes from the East. His voice, in Hebrew, there is the term that indicates noise, sound, was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. This is the translation from the Hebrew text, and it says, "The vision that I saw was like the one I saw when he came to destroy the city, and like the one I saw by the Kabar Canal." That is, Ezekiel clearly refers to a whole series of meetings. Then, I repeat, those who want to see them as single visions should also see them as visions. It is not a problem. I read what is written, and I find the description extremely concrete, extremely material, extremely precise. And it says that the Ruach took him and brought him into the inner court. Behold, the glory of the Lord filled the sanctuary. Glory of the Lord filled the sanctuary. That is, again, there is this distinction between the Ruach and the Kavod, two, so to speak, different objects. But the verse that interests us is this: His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. What does the Greek Bible, that is the Bible of the 70s, say in this verse? We have to think that perhaps it had a different source, because it says kai phone tes paremboles, which means the voice, the sound of the entrance, that is, the sound of the arrival, osphon, as voice, as the sound of plasia zonton polon, of multiplying many, increasing many, not great waters. So, the fact that we are talking about a great noise is evident both in the Hebrew Bible and in the Greek Bible. But here it is clearly said that with the arrival of Yahweh's kavod, this sound increases. That is, little by little, this sound, this noise is increasing. And here this concept is very clear. This description is very clear. And then he says, Kai ege, and the earth that is the underlying land, exalampen osphegos amotes doxes. And the underlying land became bright as light arising from this kavod of Yahweh, kuklaten, all in a circle around there. This is a concept that is here in the Greek Bible and is very clear. Then we have this kavod of Yahweh, whose noise becomes louder and louder, and the light it emits illuminates the earth below in a circle. This reminds me of the chariot horses of Athena and Hera, of that chariot used by Athena and Hera who were below. Now I know that it may seem, in quotation marks, blasphemous to talk about engines, but frankly, reading with an open mind, with a serene mind, with a free mind, nothing else comes to mind. I think that if I had to describe these situations, I had to describe these words, I had to describe these concepts with abstract concepts, I would be forced to jump through hoops because I wouldn't know how to justify them. Because both Homer and the Bible describe very concrete situations to us, and we, as usual, pretend that they are true. Among other things, we are not the only ones to pretend, because, for example, Dr. Jeff Benner, who is the founder and president of the Center for Ancient Hebrew Studies, who has created several dictionaries. In one of his, in this, in which he collected 1,000 verbs and words of particular importance, he examined the term kavod, and in the translations it indicates, precisely, kavod with this wording means armament, weapon. Then here he does a whole analysis on the term kavod, on the etymology, To arrive at the conclusion that the original concrete meaning of kavod is a battle weapon, and it was the one that Yahweh used. In the various passages that he examines, among other things, he also examines Psalm 24, which is very interesting for a number of reasons. Meanwhile, it is the psalm that Monsignor Balducci had already cited years ago, who was a person who dealt with these issues within the Vatican. The psalm begins with, "To Yahweh belongs the earth and all that it contains, the world and those who live in it." And Monsignor Balducci already pointed out how the Bible knew the earth with its inhabitants and the rest of the universe with other inhabitants and said, here, the Bible actually recognizes the existence of individuals from other worlds. And this is already an interesting element, but returning to the topic of flying tanks, something very interesting is said here. From verse 7 onwards, the psalm reads like this, "Lift up your lintels, raise up eternal gates for yourselves, so that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, the strong one, the hero, the Lord, the hero in battle. Raise up your architraves, raise up eternal gates for the King of glory to enter in." Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts, he is the King of glory. And here it is clearly said that there are doors that must raise their upper part, and they raise it following an order. That is, they are told, lift or doors. The gates here are called in two different ways. They are called petachim and sharim. And for example, in English, they are also translated as gates. It is therefore said that these doors must open because the Lord of glory must pass through them. That is, the Lord of the Kavod, who, as they say here, is the hero in battle. That is, the strong warrior, exactly like the concept taken up by Dr. Benner when he says that the Kavod is a battle weapon. Then, here there is the question of eternal doors. Eternal in Hebrew is rendered by the term olam. Olam not only does not mean eternity, but it means something unknown and very often actually refers to a place, an unknown space. So the curious thing is that in this psalm, in which Monsignor Balducci recognized that the Bible mentioned two types of inhabitants, those of the world here, that is, of the earth, and those of the universe. Therefore, inhabitants of other parts of the cosmos. We talk about a journey that Yahweh does with his kavod, and that he passes through doors. Doors that open onto the olam. Therefore, not eternal doors, but doors that open onto a place not known. As if Yahweh with his kavod, with his weapon of battle, sometimes passed from this to another world, passing through two types of doors. A type of doors that is found here, and a type of doors that it would be found somewhere else. Well, all this is very fascinating. All this is collected in a single psalm, which, as I have already said several times, are in reality not hymns of praise intended as prayers as they are normally represented to us, but are songs of glory to the warrior commander. And this hymn is a particular example of this. So in reality, there are many flying chariots, flying objects in the Bible. Certain descriptions, as we have seen, correspond to those found in the Homeric poems, but not only. If we then went on to talk about what they write about them in the poems of the so-called Oriental religions, we would have lots of carts there. But the important thing is to know that these ancient texts demonstrate knowledge of a particular type of objects, and we have the duty to pretend that this is true, otherwise we risk inventing. Inventing a lot and no longer understanding anything. Bye, thank you, and see you next time.